Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Collier. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Captain Kyle Killing. I represent the appellant, Petty Officer Collier, in this case. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd ask for 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank please you.
Your Honors, intimate sexual relationships are different than friendships, no matter how close. The range of emotions and reactions that can occur given the breakup of an intimate sexual relationship can be extreme, especially when compared with the ending of a friendship. Appellant's theory of the defense in this case was that Agent Sue Cummings set her up, particularly that she went out and purchased these tools, brought them to the command to set her up to get her in trouble with her command.
Wait, she purchased the tools and then put the squadron designators on them?
That was
the theory that she went and she impressed the squadron designators on them?
Yes, Your Honor, and there was an etching device found with the tools that were recovered from Agent Cummings' house, so that would have given her the opportunity to serve.
What evidence was there that there was a sexual relationship?
The evidence was the testimony of the appellant, Petty Officer Collier, who explained that they had about a 4 to 5 month relationship that was sexual.
This is what appears on page 44 of the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the relationship is described in the following detail, yes, ma'am? I'm just making sure that I'm not missing any other information that would indicate that in fact there was a sexual.
Excuse me, sir. Joint Appendix, page 23, record 44, where she says, so when you say that this was a romantic relationship, was it a sexual relationship? Yes, sir. And when did your sexual relationship with her end? Approximately in March of this year. So she explained that it was a sexual relationship the entire time, about a 4 to 5 month period, sir.
And that's the full extent of the information that was before the judge indicating that it was a sexual relationship?
Yes, Your Honor.
What else was before the judge on this scene?
The government presented evidence to try and rebut that. The government cross-examined the appellant, and also they presented the affidavit from Brandy Severson, who is the daughter of Agent Sue Cummings, 16-year-old daughter. And that affidavit just said that Petty Officer Collier and my mother were good friends, but there was nothing more to that relationship than that. That was an affidavit. Appellant did not get the opportunity to cross-examine Brandy Severson and did actually motion to compel her, which was denied by the military judge as well. The government also presented which was meant to be a restraining order, which wasn't an actual restraining order, but rather just a certified letter to Cummings, to appellant, explaining that I would ask that you do not contact me, you do not contact my daughter, you stay away from me, etc. So that was the extent of the government's evidence that there was no sexual relationship on the motion.
Did the military judge enter any findings as to whether there was or was not a sexual relationship in this case for purposes of the motion?
He did not, sir.
So how do we proceed at this point? That is, do we proceed on the basis that the sexual nature of the relationship was demonstrated? That is, I'm trying to figure out how to use the decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals. The Court of Criminal Appeals indicates that 403 balancing was done in this case. How do we know what was balanced by the judge? That is, did the judge in this case determine that there was a sexual relationship and that the evidence was more prejudicial than probative and should be excluded? Or did the judge determine that there was no sexual relationship and therefore there was nothing to be excluded? What is the impact of the decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals on how we view this case?
To answer your question, sir, I believe the military judge said the evidence was relevant. He did not say, he said basically that the defense has put on evidence to show that there was a sexual relationship for the entire 4 month period. He also said the government has put on evidence to refute that there was a sexual relationship for that four-month period. Then
specifically, is that the full statement of what he said? Findings of fact, the government presented evidence by cross-examination of the accused and by affidavit that tends to refute any sexual aspects of the relationship.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. He said that it tended to refute the evidence. But in essence, he did not specifically determine whether or not the sexual relationship had actually occurred. He specifically said that it does not matter because 403 prejudice is going to keep it out.
Well, for purposes of where we are then, does that not leave us with a determination that for purposes of the ruling, the military judge assumed that there was a sexual relationship and that he would exclude it either because it wasn't relevant or for some balancing reason? But is that not the posture we're in right now?
I believe
in this
that's
case?
Correct, sir, yes.
And what did the military judge balance on the record?
MRE 403 and MRE 611, and he said that the court finds that the sexual nature of this relationship is not sufficiently relevant to go over MRE 403, the concerns of MRE 403 and MRE 611. So I guess I would say that, and part of my argument is that both the military judge and NMCCA never specifically said what the prejudice in this case is. They never made a determination that it was either the confusion of the issues, embarrassment to the witness. They just got to the final conclusion.
Well, the Court of Criminal Appeals identified something about homosexuality as being prejudicial.
Yes, sir.
Is it that, what is it that they didn't do, with, in your view, with respect to that information?
Well, I believe that they went directly to the prejudicial nature of the homosexual relationship, and they found that it was particularly inflammatory in a court-martial setting. And because of, and strictly based upon that inflammatoriness, with a particular inflammatory nature in our military, that they kept it out because it just wasn't sufficiently relevant, as the military judge said.
Did the Court of Criminal Appeals say who would be prejudiced by the introduction of that information?
No, Your Honor. Never, they did not specifically say which party or confusion of the issues or any of the other concerns under MRE 403.
Is your argument here that, or perhaps it's in the alternative, that the error here is in the improper 403 balancing because it's not fully established on the record? Or is your argument that this stuff should have come in to show bias, prejudice, and motive?
It's the argument that it should have come in to show bias and prejudice. And getting back to the appellant's evidence on the motion was the appellant testified directly that there was a sexual relationship. The government did not call any other witnesses. They did not call Agent Hugh Cummings to rebut that. They relied simply upon the affidavit of Brandi Severson, the daughter, and this restraining order. So therefore, based upon a preponderance of the evidence, the appellant believes that they put enough evidence on to show, first of all, that there was a relationship, or at least had enough to have a good faith basis to go forward and present evidence at trial.
As a matter of legal policy, if this is sufficient evidence, and I'm not suggesting that it's not, and the issue here is not one of how the balancing was done, but rather that this met the threshold full stop, what protection, if any, is there for a witness, a complaining witness, when the accused says, well, I did drugs with them. This is all about our prior drug use together. Or this is all fill in the blank, nefarious activity here that will create motive to retaliate.
I think it gets back to the probative value of the evidence, sir. In this particular case, it's defense's entire theory of the case that Agent Hugh Cummings set her up, and she set her up based upon the emotional.
But couldn't it be that could, if that's the model, then anytime someone complains about me, I say my theory of the case is this is all retaliation because I know about their drug use.
Well,
if we should, 611 seems to contemplate some protection for witnesses. What's the best way to protect the witness? Of course, if the witness is, if it's true, that's the tension, which is you've got to protect the accused as well. But
right. I guess it comes down, in cases such as this one, where it's a credibility determination between two witnesses, Agent Two Cummings, who's the government's star witness in this case, and appellant, one saying that the Agent Two Cummings set her up, the other one saying, no, I never would do that. This is where I found this evidence.
So is the error here failure to recognize that the threshold was met, or is the failure to indicate on the findings that so-and-so was credible or so-and-so was not?
I think
there's a question in there.
I believe it's a failure that the threshold was met by the defense. And then also, judge never made any findings going towards credit.
See, because arguably it's a fairly low threshold if all that is required is to respond to your lawyer twice, yes, ma'am.
Well, during cross-examination, I understand what you're saying, sir, but during cross-examination...
Versus the judge then saying, I found that to be incredible, or that was credible, or some other thing.
I would cite the Gray case, United States versus Gray, which is cited in the appellant's brief, and also the Moss case. And both those cases, particularly the Gray, the facts in Gray was that the appellant alleged that a 9-year-old girl had actually made sexual advances towards him, and it was an indecent acts case. The 9-year-old girl, appellant wanted to bring in evidence that the 9-year-old girl was sexually active and that she had actually seen her parents involved in sexual relations on a couple of occasions, which therefore made her knowledge basis that much greater. And appellant was denied that opportunity. CMA, Court of Military Appeals, found that was not harmless because it made appellant's incredible explanation otherwise believable. And similarly, in the Moss case, it deprived the defense of his best defense. In this case, best defense is showing this homosexual relationship and showing the animosity that comes between the two. It certainly makes appellant's case that much more believable. And what the government specifically argued is that based upon the ending of a friendship, it was highly unlikely that the Agent Two Cummings would go to such great lengths to set up appellant.
Well, that brings up the question of prejudice. Assuming it was error to keep this stuff out.
Yes, sir.
Where's the prejudice? You had the tools were there. They got squadron markings on them. You know, there's a whole bunch of evidence apart from any sexual relationship,
yes, sir.
Which, if credited, your client's gone. Where's the prejudice?
The prejudice is the fact that the appellant didn't get to put forth their civic theory. And then the government, and I would also...
What I'm saying is, isn't there overwhelming evidence apart from... you know, motive to lie, fabricate, what have you, growing out of a truncated sexual relationship.
Well, appellant would allege that, obviously, appellant as a tool room coordinator would have had an opportunity. Appellant's not going to refute that in any way. However, the Agent Two Cummings, the whole theory was that Agent Two Cummings set her up. And the evidence on that is there was approximately 50% of the tools had etchings on it.
Mm-hmm. Was it the general course of squadron policy to put etchings on them, or does that in the record?
That did they mark the tools? Right?
Yeah.
Yes, there was a general policy, but not all tools.
But not all the tools. Okay.
Also, there was testimony from Petty Officer Stafford, which explained that the command didn't even have an inventory, a master inventory. So appellant argued to the members is that government hasn't even shown that these are the tools of the command, and that's in their argument.
Is the theory that Cummings snuck in there, stole the tools, and planted them, or is the theory that she went to Lowe's, bought identical tools, etched them, and planted them, or does it matter?
Well, it shouldn't matter.
No, but what is the theory?
I think the defense was going more along the lines of she purchased them or somehow her boyfriend was also, her boyfriend became
a husband. She was a hospital. She was a corpsman, wasn't she? So she wouldn't ordinarily be running around the tool shed.
That's correct, sir. But she had been there on two occasions, at least two occasions, visiting appellant. Also, her boyfriend, husband, after, who later became her husband, was maintenance, was retired. I don't remember his exact term, but he was dealing with maintenance. So he had some knowledge of tools. So
did he work there?
Theory was, I'm sorry, sir.
Did the boyfriend work there or have?
No, he was retired at the time.
Okay.
So Appellant's theory was that given the animosity between her, both her and H.M. 2 Cummings, and the whole reason a lot of this animosity came about was because the boyfriend, Andrew Board, did not like Appellant, and they got into numerous arguments, etc. Those two set her up in some way, where they purchased the materials, which was testified to that they are all would have been obtainable from a Sears or another mm-hmm. general hardware store.
They weren't something by General Dynamics that the
no, but he also stated,
Navy paid $5,000 a wrench for.
And if you see the tool list, I mean, most of it's wrenches and
right.
It's pretty standard stuff.
Yeah, it's standard stuff you could get from Sears. It's not,
yes, Your Honor.
But you know, strange stuff.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
What about the etching device? Is that something I can do? Well, forget me, I can't do much. But,
There wasn't any.
When you say etching, what do we mean by etching?
The etching, the commands code into the tool. So assuming it's a wrench, they would etch
it. I mean, you just scratch it in with a knife, or is this
there was some sort of
press of some sort that only the squadron would have, or what's the record reflect?
The record doesn't reflect exactly what etching means or what how long it goes about etching. But there was an etching device, some sort of tool, some sort of device, which does the etching.
There is an etching device.
And that was found at H.M. 2 Cummings' apartment.
Is there anything in the record that indicates whether that was the etching device is something that would be within the control of the custodian of the tools? How'd that device get from the squadron to the house?
The appellant would have had access to it, yes, sir. That's what you're asking, sir. She would have had access to it.
Well, and or what was your theory on how the etching device got from the squadron to the house?
Again, sir, it comes back to we're not exactly sure where the tools came from, and that's the appellant's entire theory here, is that somehow these tools were obtained by H.M. 2 Cummings, and where they came from, we were not positive. It gets back
counsel,
to
counsel. Does the record reflect that either the tools or the etching device were or were not unique military items of equipment, one way or another? You've got time to answer that question.
Thank you, sir. The record again says that most, if not all, of the items were purchased at could be purchased at a Sears or another Commerce store.
What about the etching device itself? Is that reflected as being a unique military item or not? Or does the record not say with respect to the etching device? Thank you. You'll have an opportunity to have a rebuttal.
Thank you, sir.
Counsel for the government.
If it please the court, I am Colonel Lou Puglio, and I represent the United States. The appellant in this case misconstrues a right under the Sixth Amendment. All the Sixth Amendment requires is that the accused have the opportunity to conduct effective cross-examination in order to establish possible biases, prejudices, or motive to fabricate. Davis versus Alaska and its progenies, have set forth various tests that this court and district courts have adopted. And while they say different things, they all have four common elements under the Sixth Amendment. The first is that the accused have the opportunity to cross-examine. The second is that the opportunity exists so that they can develop facts in order to allow the members to infer the testimonial motives or influence that relate to bias, prejudice, or motive to fabricate. Once that is satisfied, once they are given sufficient opportunity, the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation is satisfied.
Well, how do you answer the contention that they couldn't get what they needed out if they danced around the nature of the relationship? You know, they could elicit that they were pals, but they couldn't elicit that they were lovers. And the defense's contention is that detonating the lover bomb is a whole different thing from talking about that they were pals and maybe shared an apartment sometime.
Yes, sir. We have to look at what the judge did allow them to do. He allowed them to bring out the nature of the relationship. All they were prevented from doing was two things. They were not allowed to introduce the sexual aspect of their relationship, if one in fact existed.
But assuming arguendo one exists.
And the sexual aspect had nothing to do, per se, with the bias. The theory of bias in this case, and there were four theories of bias, but the one we're focusing on here related to a friendship, a relationship, a very close relationship, no matter how...
I thought the theory of bias related to a spurned lover.
Well,
wouldn't you agree in the abstract that a breakup of a friendship is qualitatively different than a breakup of a marriage or a romantic relationship?
I think it would depend upon the circumstance. I think in this case it did not depend, because what the defense could have brought forth was they had a close, personal, emotional, beyond friendship relationship that was broken up due to some reason, and that you had this friend, perhaps the best friend, who had a motive then to lie and fabricate her testimony. That was the theory of bias. The rest of it, whether how you characterize the relationship.
Whose theory of bias was that?
That was the defense's theory.
Well, the defense wanted to get this in, that their theory of bias was that it was a spurned lover, with all that implies.
And that is true. However, the question becomes whether the spurned lover is, one, relevant, or two, necessary in order to satisfy the Sixth Amendment.
Well, how is being pals relevant with regard to the Sixth Amendment and spurned lover not? Where's the distinction? Where's the principal distinction?
From the government's perspective, given the facts of this case, it certainly can be said that the betrayal of a best friend could have as great or greater impact than the betrayal of a casual lover.
Wait a minute. We have best friends and casual lovers. Whatever this relationship was, it appears to have been more than a one-night stand.
Well, the government disagrees. The only evidence that was brought out by this court, the only evidence you have on the record was that there was some sexual relationship. If we are to give any credence to...
Well, I thought the joint appendix said it went on for some time and ended in March.
That has nothing to do with the depth of the relationship. You could have a casual 4-month relationship. You could have a casual 10-month relationship.
Well, but they weren't afforded the opportunity to demonstrate that it was casual or uncasual. Doesn't that matter?
They absolutely were. During the 39A, it was up to the defense to bring forth why the sexual romantic relationship was important to their theory.
Counsel.
Oh, that's what you're saying. Okay.
On the 39A, yes, sir.
Okay.
The record on Joint Appendix 108, the findings of fact of the military judge, the accused testified the relationship was always sexual until it ended on or about March 2004. Then the government introduced evidence that it was not sexual. As I read the record, the military judge did not resolve that dispute. That is, I do not see any findings of fact in his ruling as to the nature of the relationship.
His ruling on page 108 and 109 of the record establishes two things. He establishes that there was some relationship, and that was
right.
But he did not state specifically, you are right, what this exact nature, whether it was romantic or otherwise.
And then on page 109, when he makes his conclusion of law, he says the court finds that the sexual nature of the relationship is not sufficiently relevant. So at this stage, are we in a situation where we go back and determine whether there was or was not a sexual relationship, or do we proceed on the basis that the judge determined and the Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed that the sexual nature of the relationship was not sufficiently relevant to be admitted into evidence?
I think it's the latter. If 109 reads, I think the judge, he could have been more specific and says, I find that the sexual nature irrelevant, not sufficiently relevant, we would contend as a euphemism.
Or he could have said that it doesn't exist, that I don't believe it, or that, but he didn't say that.
Well, the government doesn't know it. The government's position, if there was evidence, and there was some evidence on the record that there was sexual relationship, under military rule of evidence 104B, which we think this is it, the judge has the responsibility of not making the credibility determination right up front. All he has to say is there enough evidence that a reasonable member could find that this existed? Having said that, he also had a 104A responsibility, and that is, and that does allow some credibility on his side to determine the probativeness of this. And that's where he balances both.
But he didn't say anything about that in his conclusions of law. That is, he didn't say anything, as I say, the record, in which he suggested there was any lack of credibility on the part of the defense assertion. He simply noted the 2 points and went on.
Yes, that is true. Because you could assume one would have to find, well, I guess you don't have to assume that. But we could find that, I think he pretty clearly stated that it was not relevant, not sufficiently relevant.
Can you tell me what the military judge was balancing? Because it's not clear to me. He says, you know, he finds that the defense must be able to explore the issue of bias or motive. He agrees that the defense has met their preliminary burden and that this may relate to the motive to fabricate. And then he says, balancing this relevance with MRE 403 and MRE 611, basically, it's not sufficiently relevant. It's not at all clear to me what he's balancing the relevance and right against. Because, and my second question is, I understand that 611 talks about the military judge's ability to control the mode and order of cross-examination, you know, to prevent harassment, embarrassment, but I don't see anything in there, the mode or order of interrogation, I don't see anything in there or in the part of 611 that talks about cross-examination that gives the military judge a right to cut off, I'm talking about within 611 itself, to say you may not cross-examine about a particular topic at all. That's not mode or order.
Addressing your first question first, Your Honor. The record establishes this. On the relevance side, on the probativeness side of 403, the judge did state on page 109 that he found some relevance in the nature of the relationship, and that is that they had some close personal relationship. He did state in his findings that this went to the bias. That is, we had a close personal relationship over a four-month period. We were either lovers or very good friends. We broke up, and now I have a motive to lie. So that on that side was the probativeness of the equation. On the prejudice side of the equation, the judge, and I apologize, it's not in the joint appendix, but it is in the record of trial on page 63. And the judge does go into a colloquy about how this is going to be a trial within a trial. That is, this has the opportunity to mislead and confuse the members. Now, in order to understand mislead and confuse the members, we have to go to the committee notes on 403 and see what they said about what misleading and confusion means. And what that means, according to the committee notes, is that something of marginal probative value is given greater weight than it should have. And here, on page 63 of the record trial, and it continues on page 29 through 31 of the joint appendix, what you have is both sides starting to present witnesses. Defense says, we have two witnesses that we want to present that would prove the sexual nature of the relationship. The government then stands up in this 31 and says, well, we also have two witnesses that would disprove the nature of the relationship, the sexual nature of the relationship. And the judge does say on page 63, I am concerned about this trial within a trial. And if you look at the federal courts, how they interpret the confusion and misleading the members part of 403, there are generally three concerns. The first concern, as the judge in this case found, is you're going to have a mini trial. There's at least four witnesses, two on the defense, two by the prosecution, that would allow this.
Counsel, with all due respect, I don't see anything on page 63 where the judge says that he is making a finding or a conclusion of law that there's going to be a trial within a trial in this case. He, on page 63, as I read it, is discussing the government's concern about 611 and noting that the underlying rule talks about a trial within a trial. But it doesn't appear to me that he makes either a finding of fact or a conclusion of law that either there's going to be a trial within a trial in this case or that this witness is going to be harassed or anything about 611 other than his mere citation of 611 on page 109 of the joint appendix.
That is correct. I did not mean to mislead the court, but he did.
I'm not suggesting you did. I'm just trying to clarify where we are here.
Yes, sir. But he does. That is a concern of his. Well, and it's in this context of both sides representing to the court that they have additional witnesses.
Well, Colonel, let's make this instead of a tool theft, instead of it being a tool theft case, let's say it's a premeditated murder case. Okay? And the defense's theory is I'm being accused, basically it's a cross lovers sort of thing. Wouldn't a mini trial on this issue be appropriate? And if so, why isn't it appropriate in this case?
Well,
is it because it's a larceny of tools, or why is it?
No, ma'am. It's not because the crime itself doesn't matter. It's how the bias, how the defense's theory of bias is framed, number one, and what the issues are that are involved.
But you just were talking about that they were balancing the relevance against the fear about a mini trial. And my question for you is, if it goes to something like bias or motive, why isn't a mini trial appropriate?
Well, because just to back up one step, the Sixth Amendment, all the Sixth Amendment requires is some exploration of this relationship. And here, the bias that both the defense frame and the judge found, I should say that the defense doesn't get to do all they want to do. Davis versus Alaska and Van Arsdale say that once they have a sufficient opportunity to cross, and United States versus James, once they satisfy that test, the defense doesn't get to do all they want to do to pound the point home. Here, the bias was out of a relationship. And again, I say this because I think it's important to distinguish the Sixth Amendment prong of this analysis from the 403 prong.
Davis versus Alaska says we have recognized that the exposure of a witness's motivation in testifying is a proper and important function of the constitutionally protected right of cross-examination. It seems to me that your argument turns on the issue whether or not the witness's motivation, if they are a close friend, or the witness's is the same as a witness's motivation if they are former lovers.
Well, I would quote back United States versus James 61 at MJ at 136. Once the defendant has been allowed to expose the witness's motivation in testifying.
Well, but this turns on the motivation. Like, what is the motivation? In this case, the motivation that the defendant was allowed to expose was that they had been best friends. The motivation that the defense wanted to expose was that they were former lovers or whatever.
I would agree with the second characterization, that the defense wanted to portray them as lovers. I would disagree with the first characterization. I think that the judge allowed sufficient opportunity for them to explore the emotional aspect of it as long as they did not get into the sexual nature. Now,
specifically, the defense will not ask any witness if the relationship was sexual, homosexual, intimate, or romantic.
Okay, so the defense could have, there's two ways to prove a relationship. One is to ask somebody how they would characterize it, not using those terms. They could have said, we find it, we're very close emotionally. We are beyond best friends. We are close friends. We are soulmates.
And what is the danger here that the military judge is trying to protect from prohibiting the use of those terms?
I think he was trying to protect the undue prejudice. That is,
undue prejudice to who?
To both. I think both parties. Although it's not. Admittedly, it's not.
Well, only one person's on trial here.
Well, but that does not prevent the judge has an obligation, as Van Arsdale says. One of the aspects of the judge's limiting function, the wide discretion he is allowed to give, is for the safety and to prevent the harassment of witnesses. And here, given the relatively low probative value of the sexual nature, he's allowed the judge.
So preventing embarrassment to a witness trumps the confrontation rights of a defendant?
Absolutely not, sir. But once the bias is exposed, and here the bias is, and I think the distinction here is what was necessary to expose the bias? What was the probative? How did you define that relationship? The sexual aspect is mere one component of this. The crux of the issue, the crux of the bias is they had a close relationship, if you buy defense's theory. They had a close relationship, no matter how you characterize it, whether it was platonic, whether it was romantic, whether it was Christian, whether it was...
But would you agree that if I said that a couple had a close relationship, that was the same as saying that they had a romantic sexual relationship? Would you take that away from somebody saying there was a close relationship?
Not necessarily, no.
Then how would the members know that and be able to attribute a motive from a breakup of a romantic sexual relationship?
Because if I asked the witness, assuming the witness was honest with me and assuming that we had a sexual relationship going on, if I was the defense counsel and I asked the witness, how would you characterize, not using those terms, how would you characterize, we were soulmates. We were beyond best friends. I could not consider my life, I could not have considered my life to go on without this other person. Everything I knew in life.
But none of that indicates a romantic or a sexual relationship.
While it may be of minimal relevance, the judge found it not to be relevant, it's whether the 403 balancing test is satisfied. The fact that there was romantic adds really nothing to the equation.
A breakup of romance?
Well, if it adds nothing to the equation, why not let it in?
I'm sorry, sir?
Well, if it adds nothing to the relationship, then what's the rationale for not letting it in? What's 403 rationale for not letting it in?
Again, there are two. Admittedly, the judge did not specifically find these. Had I been the judge, I probably would have, but he did not find these. One, that it had the confusion of the member, we were going to get into whether or not there was a sexual relationship, and I had four witnesses lined up to prove that theory. And the second is the homosexual nature of the ship of the relationship, that it had undue prejudice.
But it's being proffered by the defense. It's not like the other cases where the defense is trying to keep it out. It's being proffered by the defense.
I think this goes in, if I may.
No,
counsel, if
say,
I may interject here, prejudice. Even though your time's going to run out, I can see there are a number of questions from the bench, so we'll just keep going as long as the questions are here.
I mean, this is related to Judge Stuckey's question, which is undue prejudice to whom?
Well, 403 allows undue prejudice, although mainly to the accused. It's not limited to the accused. I think that the judge has a responsibility across the board. There's nothing. If you compare 403 to 609, Military Rule of Evidence 609, in 609 there's a specific prejudice prong that applies to the accused when you bring out a prior conviction. There's a balancing test that is specifically relevant to the accused.
But that's because we don't want people to be convicted because they were bad people in the prior instance.
That is true, but the drafters of the rules know how to say that when we apply a prejudice test, this prejudice test applies to the accused. 403 has no such dichotomy. 403 just says undue prejudice.
Couldn't the military judge have resolved this issue by at least finding out who the witnesses were that either side claimed they were going to call?
I believe he did at one point.
Where is that in the record?
I believe it is at if I might have a moment.
And secondly, did not the military judge cut off cross-examination of the accused? The government wanted to cross-examine the accused on this, on the sexual nature, if any, of the relationship, and the military judge cut it off. And why isn't that error? It probably would have been useful to know what that cross-examination might have revealed.
Yes, Your Honor.
This would certainly be a different case for one of you if this...
to answer your first question, on page 30 of the Joint Appendix, defense counsel names Christy Travis as one of the individuals, because the judge asked her specifically, so what other witnesses would you have to prove the sexual nature of the relationship? The defense says Christy
Travis. And what was the proffer on what they'd say?
We
have a name.
Just that she was the detective, there really wasn't, and then it devolves into something else. But the defense at least put one name and did say two witnesses. On the government side, the two witnesses were obviously Cummings and Cummings' daughter, who you have the affidavit.
Why isn't it error to shut off the cross-examination, which might have resolved this issue?
Well, and I see I'm way over my time.
You have all the time you need to answer Judge Baker's question.
I have to get back to the 403 question, but the judge cut off the trial counsel's cross-examination because the defense said that it was beyond the scope. I think the judge was wrong. He was just wrong. He should have allowed the trial counsel to go beyond that.
He erred against
the government. I think the defense counsel put this witness up there and tried to limit her testimony.
Whether it was against the government or not, did he err in terms of being able to create a record that would allow him to do a proper 403 balancing?
No, Your Honor. That's not the defense. That's not the government's theory. That's not the defense's theory as well, if I can speak to that.
You're arguing both sides today, and now you'll come up here.
I think there are sufficient facts. Now, I agree that, and the government concedes that the judge could have done a better job in articulating the balancing approach. However, there are facts on the record which, as a matter of law, that this court could find allow the judge to weigh these factors. And again, the undue prejudice and the confusion and misleading the members, the trial within the trial. If I may just jump back to the 403 and undue prejudice. Undue prejudice is defined by the drafters to mean that the members would not make a decision based upon the logic and facts of the case. Rather, they would make a decision based upon emotion. I know of no case law that confines 403 strictly to undue prejudice to the accused. Rather, the judge looks at it through the eyes of the members and says, will they be able to make a decision based upon the facts and logic of the case, or are they going to make it on some inappropriate grounds, such as emotion?
So that even if it was highly relevant and highly probative to this appellant, that the main witness against her was in her homosexual relationship to her, with her, in your view, because the... members might be inflamed by the fact that they had been in a homosexual relationship, that would be a proper ground for excluding the evidence?
No, Your Honor, but that's not what the judge found. The judge found that the sexual relationship was not relevant, and he found that the...
No, he didn't. He did not.
He found it was of... I forget the exact words, but I thought we all had agreed, or at least had the sexual relationship was not sufficiently relevant.
Which does not go to probative value.
Well, there's a difference... There's a difference between relevance and probative. It has to be relevant before it becomes probative. Probativeness is just the weight of the evidence. Here, the judge seemed to say, under the sexual nature of it, that it's not sufficiently relevant. Granted, it could be read two ways. The government would read that as saying he found it to be irrelevant because in his next sentence, or the preceding sentence, he says the nature of the relationship, that has some relevance. Some marginal relevance, some relevance. So to get back to your specific question, 403 requires a substantial, the probative value be substantially outweighed by the undue prejudice. If it's of great probative value, then no, it would have to come in.
Counsel, in that regard, was it appropriate for the Court of Criminal Appeals, with all due regard to those who wrote the dissent in Phillips, to rely on the dissent in Phillips rather than majority opinion?
Your Honor, I think, as the dissent in Phillips brought out, the military is a unique institution. There are certainly that's a hot button issue, and as defense in Phillips points out, we have a different society here. Not that it's bias or prejudice, but that there's an extra element that does not exist in the civilian world.
But didn't the majority in Phillips find that that was not sufficient to overcome, in that case, the balance in terms of admission of the evidence?
Yes, sir, but Phillips was a wholly different case, and if I recall correctly, it wasn't a bias case. That was brought out as part of the evidence that the government needed to prove its case.
I'm just trying to figure out where the CCA was going and relied on a dissenting opinion.
I think the CCA was just trying to demonstrate, as the dissent pointed out, that this is a hot-button issue that has a different connotative analysis. I think the decision, the majority decision, I say this realizing how the majority decision of Phillips was right, but having said that, there always is that extra element there.
Unless there are any further questions, if you'd like to briefly sum up, you may do so.
Yes, sir. I think that the crux of this issue is what was required under the Sixth Amendment. And all that was required under the Sixth Amendment is some evidence of the bias that was here. And if I just may state to the record, on page 176 of the Joint Appendix, the judge did allow some leeway to get into a crush, that the accused had a crush on the witness, and that formed a concern of the witness that could have led to bias. So the judge didn't wholly strike this whole area of law. It allowed them some leeway, and allowed them more leeway, whether they took it or not. It is irrelevant under the Sixth Amendment analysis. Thank you. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal? And while 3 minutes may be well sufficient, since the government had extra time, if you need extra time, let us know.
I wanted to make a quick point about the unfair prejudice. What we're concerned about is the members, whether the members would have heard this homosexual orientation evidence and therefore have made some sort of emotional or irrational decision in this case. I want to point out that the military judge, even after determining that this evidence couldn't come in, did ask the members during voir dire whether or not homosexual orientation would have caused them to make some sort of fair or impartial decision. That's a Joint Appendix 121, and they all responded in the negative. So Pelham would put that forth that right there the members are saying, we're not going to be prejudiced by hearing this evidence, which therefore means it should have been allowed, or should have been at least appellant should have been allowed to put forth the evidence. Also,
why should the judge be bound by the answers? Then, if we're going to go back to what was said in the dissent in Phillips, why couldn't the judge make a determination if he so viewed the facts and law in this case? As determining, I understand you're not agreeing with it, but didn't he have the power, irrespective of the members' answers, to say, because of the nature of this issue, it is so inflammatory that it would confuse the members in any court-martial case, and I'm not going to let it in under the facts of this case. Didn't he have the power to do that?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Pellant also wanted to point out that it's not included in the Joint Appendix, but at a record at 605 and 620, this is the government's closing argument in the case. The government argues that. Is there any doubt that, does anyone actually believe that Petty Officer Cummings would have done all this, created this whole thing? These tools are worth about $2,500. Right there, the government has proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt. They also went on to stress that, are we supposed to believe that Petty Officer Cummings or somebody else went out and spent $2,700 on tools to set this up because she's mad at somebody? That strains all logic. It's just not credible. And that is the whole theory of the appellant's argument and case is, first of all, that she did go out and set her up. And the only reason, the only way appellant could make that highly unlikely scenario somewhat plausible, somewhat believable, was to present this evidence of a sexual relationship and all the emotions that were involved, which could lead a person to do some, I guess, crazy things otherwise they wouldn't have done. And that is the crux of the appellant's theory in this case. Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:55 a.m.
Rise.